Would you please call court to order, please?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Larkin, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. preside.
Thank you. Good morning. Today is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2021. We have four cases set for our calendars today. One is set for oral argument. That is A20-1620, Vicki Metcalf versus Allina Health System. Council, we will be following the normal rules of procedure, with the exception that you don't have to worry about standing. There's no podium for you to have to stand in front of. This is being held via Zoom. We will be recording this. No other recordings are permitted unless permission is given beforehand. Because it is being held virtually, there may be technical issues that we run into. And if we do, we'll certainly make sure that we accommodate the parties, including needing to stop to or reset the time to make sure that both of you have enough time to make your oral arguments. Otherwise, appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent and 5 minutes by appellant for rebuttal, if you so choose. You may see us either raise a hand physically or raise the virtual hand in case we have any questions, or interrupt if there is a pause where we can interject. And with that, counsel for appellant, if you can state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Redden. I represent the appellant and plaintiff in this case, Vicki Metcalf. We are here today to ask that the court reverse the district court's order granting Allina's motion for summary judgment and to remand for further proceedings. And we have brought this appeal because the district court failed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to our client, Ms. Metcalf, as required by the summary judgment standard. Now, briefly, as set forth in our papers, Ms. Metcalf alleges a single count for retaliatory discharge in violation of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. Ms. Metcalf reported some concerns about one of her employees, Robert Messer, to her human resources contact, Deb Foster, including that Mr. Messer was arrested for an alleged domestic assault and that he had allegedly engaged in other unconfirmed but certainly inappropriate behavior. Ms. Foster told Ms. Metcalf to keep him on the schedule as he was being investigated, so Ms. Metcalf complied. But then a new human resources director, Ms. McElmurry, became involved, and she decided that Mr. Messer needed to be sent home immediately. Ms. Foster called and delivered the news to Ms. Metcalf, who was concerned because Mr. Messer was needed to co-supervise a pulmonary rehabilitation class in order to ensure patient safety and to meet the standard of care for those classes. Ms. Foster recommended that Ms. Metcalf contact Ms. McElmurry to discuss it, so she did. She explained to Ms. McElmurry that sending Mr. Messer home would leave the pulmonary rehabilitation class understaffed, endanger patients, and not meet the standard of care.
So, Mr. Redden, if I could stop you right there. I think you take the position that the discussion that your client had with the new HR person, McElmurry, on that September 27th date was itself a protected report for purposes of the whistleblower claim. Can you explain that to me? It seems to me that what those two parties, if you will, not parties to the lawsuit, those two persons really were just discussing the appropriate response rather than making a report. So distinguish between stating a position and explaining your position versus actually making a report of illegal or unethical behavior.
Sure. When we go to the text of the statute, what it talks about is making an oral, telling somebody, hey, this thing is going to either violate the law or a statute or regulation, or telling somebody that in the medical field that this is not going to meet the accepted standard of care. And so while it certainly was in the context of discussing what is the appropriate action that we should take at this point, do we wait and let him finish? Do we wait and give me some time so that I can find somebody else to come into the class? Or do we just hope that nothing happens, pull them from the class and leave the class undersupervised? Certainly it's within that context, but within that context, she's telling Ms. McElmurry, look, we can't do this. It's going to endanger patient safety and not meet the standard of care. And Ms. McElmurry took extreme exception to this, unusual exception to this. And she reacted with, sort of vague threats and anger, and just really took exception to the pushback, so to speak, on this. And she demanded that Ms. Metcalf take Mr. Foster, Mr. Messer, escort him from the pulmonary rehabilitation class to see Ms. Foster. Ms. Foster asked Ms. Metcalf to stick around for the conversation, then had Ms. Metcalf walk him to get his items and to escort him from the building, leaving the pulmonary rehabilitation class understaffed that whole time.
And I understand there was a difference of opinion as between the HR person and your client about whether it was appropriate to leave the class, well, or that it was appropriate to remove one of the two people supervising that class. But again, you know, the case law distinguishes between, you know, making report or providing information that's in the normal course of duties, which I think in this point would be Ms. Metcalf, the expert respiratory therapist, saying you really need to have two people in there. I mean, that's not a report for purposes of Whistleblower Act. So why are the reports, frankly, or why is the discussion and the pushback your client made on September 27th and October 4th protected reports under the Whistleblower Act?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that prior to the changes to the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, there was some case law that talked about whether somebody was stepping out of their lane, you know, out of their job duties and then making a protected report. That case law has been overruled. The Minnesota Supreme Court recognized that in Friedlander. And all we're doing here is we're applying the text of the statute. The report is defined, a good faith is defined, and the report requires that she tell them, you know, this violates, words that to the effect of this violates the law, which she did, or words to the effect that this doesn't meet the standard of care, which she did, and that she do it in good faith, which means that when she's saying it, she's not, you know, lying or being reckless with regard to the truth. And so under the amendments to the Whistleblower Act and under Friedlander, when you follow the text of the statute, we think that this is clearly considered a protected report.
So is there no longer a requirement that the report be made to expose illegality or in the case of a healthcare provider, failure to provide quality care or placing patients at risk?
Yes, there's no longer a requirement that that the person do it for the specific purpose of exposing an illegality. If the person exposes an illegality in the regular course of business or exposes a lack of meeting the standard of care and then is retaliated against, it is just as illegal as it is if they did it for a business purpose or for the purpose of exposing an illegality. Yes, Your Honor. So in any event, Ms. McElmurry took exception to this series of events and decided to go ahead and investigate the messenger, which was strange in other circumstances, given that when you view the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Metcalf, she'd done nothing wrong. So in this investigation, they sit her down for this interview, and Ms. McElmurry again tears into Ms. Metcalf. And a third-party witness described Ms. McElmurry's conduct during this investigatory meeting as very heated, aggressive, and accusatory. And that same witness had previously heard Ms. McElmurry state that in investigations, she would go to any length to get her man or woman. Now, ultimately, Ms. McElmurry completed her sham investigation into Ms. Metcalf. She drafted a retaliatory timeline full of falsehoods and material omissions to paint Ms. Metcalf in the worst light possible. And then she gave that timeline to Allina management in a successful effort to get Ms. Metcalf fired, which brings us here today. Now, the district court held that Ms. Metcalf did engage in protected conduct when she reported that Ms. McElmurry was going to leave the pulmonary rehabilitation class insufficiently staffed. The district court held, however, that there was insufficient evidence of causal connection between that protected conduct and Ms. Metcalf's termination. In making that holding, the court erred by failing to view the entirety of the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Metcalf. Now, first, under the Dietrich v. Canadian Pacific case cited in our materials, to establish a causal connection sufficient to establish a prima facie case, all Ms. Metcalf must do is point to evidence of circumstances that justify an inference of retaliatory motive. This includes a showing that the employer had knowledge of the protected activity and that the adverse employment action follows closely in time.
Mr. Redden, let's assume we agree with you and that we agree that the district court erred by concluding that your client hadn't made a prima facie showing. What is the strongest evidence to support a determination that the discharge was a pretext for retaliation based on the protected conduct?
Sure. The strongest evidence I would point to is, first of all, Ms. McElmurry's conduct, both during the September 27th phone call and in the course of the investigation when she sat down with Ms. Metcalf and was again very heated and aggressive. And then third, I would point to Ms. McElmurry's response when she was told that Ms. Metcalf wanted to file a formal complaint against her. She responded to that by, again, telling lies about Ms. Metcalf and painting her in a light that wasn't favorable. She said that during that September 27th phone call, Ms. Metcalf just needed a body, right? And that she just, didn't want to send him home because, you know, she felt like she would have too much work to do and that she was missing these meetings. When in fact, what the primary issue Ms. Metcalf had was that at that moment, he was needed in order to meet the standard of care and ensure patient safety. And the other strongest piece of evidence is the timeline itself, because it leaves out critical information that casts Ms. Metcalf in an extremely different light. And I will give one example I think that is most indicative of what happened with this timeline. So during the investigation, Ms. Metcalf couldn't recall exactly when it was that she reported to Ms. Foster that Mr. Messer had been involved in this domestic dispute and that he had been arrested. She couldn't recall. She gave one date and then she gave another. But the entire time, she insisted that she had immediately brought the, you know, when she found out about it, she took it right to HR, that that Ms. Foster reviewed the policy and said, keep him on. And in fact, when the issue came up again after the new director came on, right, Ms. Foster bounced it off her again in an email and said, you know, we understand that he was arrested and, you know, for this domestic incident, he has these things going on. And then she had a list of recommendations at the end of her email. And those clearly stated, we should, you know, that her, Ms. Foster's recommendation was the same then as it was when Ms. Metcalf went to see her, which is leave him on until, you know, there's a trial. And if he's found guilty, well, then we'll address it then. And then she talks about, you know, investigating Mr. Messer's other conduct. And there's clearly an anticipation that he's going to continue to be employed, right? It's a reasonable response because there's a range of reasonable responses to the situation. But when Ms. McElmurry drafts the timeline, she does it to support her desired conclusion. Her desired conclusion being that Ms. Metcalf did not report it immediately to HR, that Ms. Metcalf just hoped to, I don't know, sweep it under the rug or something like that and not take the situation seriously. And in order to achieve that, she failed to note that Ms. Metcalf had consistently through the investigation insisted that she had reported it immediately to Ms. Foster. She completely left that out. In addition, she completely left out, she quoted all of Ms. Foster's email relating to the situation, but left out Ms. Foster's recommendations, right? And she did that because she wanted to, I think a reasonable jury could conclude that she did that for the specific purpose of trying to ensure that management didn't think, oh, well, this is within the range of reasonable responses. She did it for the purpose of making Ms. Metcalf look bad and to justify her termination. And there are several other items that Ms. McElmurry
Mr. Redden, when you read the whole report in context, I mean, I think very early in the timeline, there is a reference, I mean, albeit it was the reference to your client making the report to Ms. Foster in July rather than April, but I think the timeline does indicate that the communication was made and that Foster, they discussed it and that there was no indication there by or no suggestion that Foster disagreed with keeping Mr. Messer on the schedule pending the completion of the criminal case. So, I mean, the overall communication seems to me to not be telling the decision makers that it was wrong and that HR never agreed with your client's position. Isn't that true?
No, Your Honor, I think that actually what the way that that was presented is that Ms. Metcalf knew about it well before July, mentioned in July to Deb Foster that, oh, he was involved in a domestic incident, left out the fact that she told her it was an arrest, and that only later in September did Ms. Metcalf mention that it was in fact an arrest. And so that kind of paints a different picture, Your Honor.
Mr. Redden, I just want to make sure I understand your argument in terms of there are two ways to argue the pretextual. One is directly by showing a discriminatory reason likely motivated by the employer, or indirectly by showing that the employer's explanation is unworthy of credence. Which argument are you leaning on with all the facts that you just, or all the information I should say you mentioned there?
Both, Your Honor. One, the way that the ultimate conclusions that the timeline was drafted to support are false. And secondly, the timeline itself and Ms. Montgomery's conduct, and given that it's entirely her timeline that management says that they relied on, that she through circumstantial evidence, we can show that that was drafted with retaliatory intent. So we're taking both tracks, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the panel members at this time? Okay, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing.
May it please the court. My name is Taryn Chambers and I'm representing Allina Health System. And unless the court prefers otherwise, I won't spend time going through the facts of this matter since Mr. Redden has already reiterated them and we have briefed them at length. But one thing I will note, I'm just responding to what Mr. Redden has stated. We absolutely agree that, of course, for purposes of this motion, the facts have to be viewed in the light most favorable to Ms. Metcalf. However, the recitation of the facts that Mr. Redden just gave regarding the conduct on September 27th are not even the facts as reported by Ms. Metcalf, right? We are lucky here today that we have Exhibit 22 to our summary judgment motion, which is Ms. Metcalf's recitation of the facts that she herself wrote without the aid of counsel after the end of her employment. And in there, she describes in great detail what happened on September 27th. And it was not, as Mr. Redden describes it, sort of this, I need help, please somebody help me, the patients are going to be at risk, right? She says she was told Mr. Messer had to be sent home and her response was, why, he's fine. And her response was, how is he dangerous? Anybody can accuse someone of something they didn't do. I've never seen Bob act inappropriate in any way, which includes anger issues, drug issues, or any signs of abuse. How am I going to cover 3 patient care areas, go to my 2 mandatory meetings, and keep the patient safe by myself? I think it's important to keep that in mind. That's the response Ms. Metcalf gave when she was told she needed to send Mr. Messer home. With that in mind, of course, we know that in order to survive summary judgment here, Ms. Metcalf has to make 2 showings. 1, she has to show that she engaged in protected conduct in the first place. And 2, she has to show that causal connection between her protected conduct and the termination of her employment.
Ms. Chambers, assuming that the report that removing Mr. Messer from the class would violate Rule 4640.900 subpart 2. So assuming that, I know you disagree, but assuming that, is a standard that is recognized in the healthcare industry. What are the protected reports here? What is the protected conduct?
So according to Ms. Metcalf, the protected conduct is that September 27th interaction where she stated to Ms. Metcalf, Ms. Montgomery, that the patients would be left at risk. She reiterated that on October 4th in her investigatory meeting. And I believe she is alleging that she made the same sort of sentiment to Ms. Iverson on October 1st.
So then it's undisputed that that the HR director who prepared the investigation report and made, you know, identified the issues for the decision makers was well aware of Ms. Metcalf's whistleblowing protected conduct, correct?
Assuming the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Metcalf, yes, that's undisputed. But again, Ms. Metcalf has to show that the alleged protected conduct that she engaged in was causally connected to the termination of her employment. And of course, we know here the district court found that was lacking. And the district court correctly found there was no causation here for two reasons. Ms. Metcalf's argument is one, temporal proximity, and two, the cat's paw theory. The district court found neither one of those work to establish causation here. Of course, we know three of the four decision makers
Ms. Chambers, can I stop you right there? Because I don't know if the cat's paw theory applies to the causal connection issue. I think, doesn't that go to the pretext issue?
Yes, so there is a little bit of ambiguity here with regard to how the cat's paw theory fits in with the McDonnell-Douglas standard. Here, the way that Ms. Metcalf is arguing it, she's using the cat's paw theory to establish both in her brief, and so that's how we've chosen to oppose it. But the district court correctly noted there is some confusion regarding whether you use the cat's paw theory to establish McDonnell-Douglas or you use McDonnell-Douglas to establish the cat's paw theory. Here, fortunately, I think that the elements of causation and the elements of pretext are very similar in that both require a showing of retaliatory animus. And so I think the analysis is the same for both causation and pretext in this case. Not always, but here I think they are the same. And the district court here found that there can't be, as I said, any temporal proximity given that three of the four decision makers did not know about the protected conduct. That simply is not present in the record. That they had any knowledge.
All right, but
go ahead, Judge Bjorkman. I think we might be asking the same question here.
Go ahead.
Can you cite to any case law that requires that all of the decision makers have knowledge? Because my understanding of the standard is that it's either actual or imputed knowledge. And if you have at least one person that has actual knowledge, why isn't that sufficient?
Yes, we don't have any case law that says all decision makers have to know of the protected conduct, but we have case law that says the decision makers have to know. And here, the record shows that the decision makers acted as one. They all unanimously made the decision together. They got in a room, they made the decision as one. And each had their own reason for supporting that decision. And so here, where the majority of them did not know of her protected conduct, they had no actual or imputed knowledge. The record doesn't have any facts to suggest either one of those.
Why isn't imputed knowledge to them enough if at least one of the decision makers has that actual knowledge though? I'm not aware, and I didn't see your brief any citation or the district court order for that matter, any citation to any case law that would support the approach that you're proposing.
I think there's no imputed knowledge here for a couple of reasons. This is a little bit of a different case where we're not showing actual decision maker knowledge in the first place, right? The Ms. Metcalf theory is the cat's paw theory. So in that way, her argument sort of rests on the fact that these decision makers didn't have knowledge and didn't need to have knowledge because they're relying on Ms. McElmurray's timeline, which she's alleging is retaliatory. So the fact that the decision makers did not have knowledge is sort of presumed. And that's why we're primarily arguing the cat's paw theory.
But put inside the cat's paw theory, doesn't the fact that the timeline, if there's enough information that's missing there that's disputed, why isn't that enough to meet both the pretext prong as well as the causal link prong? Because you also have the temporal element, which seems to be met here as well.
Yeah, I think that the Court of Appeals or the district court was clear that could be the case, right? There could be situations where there is enough information that's missing or there's information that's inaccurate that could rise to an inference of causal connection, especially given temporal proximity. Here, however, we don't have that. This isn't the case where we have enough omitted information or inaccurate information. And in this case, I think the district court did an outstanding job going through each of the issues, 17 issues that Ms. Metcalf raised with the timeline. And they went through them one by one. And the district court found that in large part, the elements in the timeline were directly supported by the record. They were not inaccurate. They were misleading.
But Ms. Chambers, if we look at the report in context, I mean, it does seem to me that it paints, it does not accurately portray the fact that Ms. Foster at all relevant times supported the decision to let Mr. Messer remain on the schedule and in the workplace up and until the, you know, the events of September 26th. You read the report as a whole, and I don't get that flavor from it. And doesn't that, whether you call it an omission or inaccuracy, but I mean, doesn't that sort of undermine the accuracy of the report and give us a basis to infer animus, especially when the report's prepared by the person to whom the report protected conduct was directed, and at least one decision maker knew not only of you know, the contact between McElmurry and Ms. Metcalf on the 27th of September and October 4th, but in fact received a complaint about Ms. McElmurry on October 5th.
Yeah, I don't think that's sufficient to infer retaliatory animus for a couple of reasons. First, it's undisputed, right? And the record supports that there's a lot of confusion about what happened with that initial report to Ms. Foster. Ms. Metcalf herself testified, I don't remember what date it was. It could have been in April. It could have been in July. We've got shifting timelines here for when it happened at all.
Let me stop you right there, Ms. Chambers, because we still have to look at the evidence at this stage in terms of the first step of the analysis in the light most favorable to her. So even if it's conflicting, we have to assume that April is when she disclosed it. And we have to look at all this information in the light most favorable to appellant. So it seems to me, I mean, you even seem to acknowledge that, yeah, there was some confusion there. Doesn't that just go to the fact that there's at least a disputed issue? And second, this is just at the preliminary stage right here. This isn't a decision on the merits. So all she has to do is meet her initial burden, and that burden is relatively low. So that's what causes me concern in terms of the district court's analysis on the causal connection. It almost seems that the district court was weighing the evidence rather than just looking at it in light most favorable to appellant.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. We have to take that in the light most favorable to her. But even assuming she reported that, as we must in April, she reported it right away, reported it to Ms. Foster. The fact that there's confusion about when that happened in the timeline, right? The fact that it may be misreported in the timeline doesn't show that Ms. McElmurry was acting with retaliatory animus. That's what the district court concluded. There's nothing in the record to show that there was retaliation here. What's in the record is that there was confusion, right? And that's what's reflected in the timeline. They're shifting dates. So Ms. Metcalf can't meet her burden here to avoid summary judgment by showing that Ms. McElmurry simply got it wrong. That's not the burden to survive summary judgment. She has to show retaliatory animus. And here, with respect to that particular aspect, where the record's clear there was confusion about when this event occurred, it doesn't show that she was being retaliatory, right? It shows that she was reporting what she knew at the time. She was reporting what she was told at the time. That can't be retaliatory when she's simply reporting what Ms. Foster told her occurred and what Ms. Metcalf at the time had told her occurred. That's not retaliation just because it ended up not being true ultimately.
Well, but don't we have an issue with that report with, as Judge Berkman pointed out, that there's some material omissions. I mean, the report is not, it just doesn't sound neutral at all. It sounds extremely slanted to paint Ms. Metcalf in the most unfavorable light and omitting key information. And why isn't that enough to say, you know, that shows a retaliatory, there's an inference of retaliation based on a slanted report?
So first, I would disagree that there was a finding or that the record supports that there was significant omissions from the timeline. Again, the district court went through each of these one by one and found that for the most part, they are very accurate. The assertions in the timeline are supported by the record and often Ms. Metcalf's own testimony. Now, the district court did find there were four instances where perhaps the timeline did not exactly align with the record. One, it was not stated whether or not it was Ms. Metcalf's duty to confirm with the licensing board that he could continue practicing with this arrest on his record. to, didn't include the entire quote about why Ms. Metcalf said, I wish I wouldn't have come forward with this information. Three, it didn't include Ms. Metcalf's statement that she was already planning to miss meetings on the day of September 27th. And four, as Mr. Redden pointed out, Ms. McElmurry included Ms. Foster's email in the timeline, but omitted to, or did not include her recommendations that ultimately weren't followed anyway. Four things from the timeline that don't comport with the record.
But isn't there, I mean, I'm looking at the issues identified, you know, and they, and the, one of the issues was that Messer was allowed to work 48 shifts after Vicki found out he'd been arrested. Again, without saying that, you know, it, at some point Metcalf ran it by HR. I mean, that seems to me a material omission, and, you know, that omission and the overall failure to discuss the fact that she did have HR's Foster's blessing for some of these things, coupled with the evidence that of McKellery's conduct during the September 27th and October 4th meeting. I mean, why isn't that enough, at least at the pretext stage, to get to a jury as opposed to decide summary judgment?
Because again, she has to show retaliation there. She has to show that when Ms. McElmurry was sitting down writing, she missed 48, or allowed him to work 48 shifts. She has to show that Ms. McElmurry was writing that with retaliatory animus. She can't do that because at the time, that's what she knew. And Ms. Metcalf is admitting that at the time, she may have given her incorrect information about when she learned of this, whether she learned of it in July, whether she learned of it in April, when she went to Ms. Foster, whether it was in July, whether it was in April. There's confusion about when these things occurred. So when Ms. McElmurry is writing it down, she's not writing it with retaliatory animus. She's writing what she knew. She's writing what was reported to her at the time. The showing of retaliation there is missing and is required.
So is evidence of Ms. McElmurry's conduct during the September 27th meeting and her conduct on October 4th, is that relevant evidence on the question of pretext?
I don't think so, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. First of all, Mr. Redden raises that on appeal here as something that can show that Ms. McElmurry was acting with retaliatory animus. The district court didn't discuss that or analyze that because Mr. Redden didn't raise that argument before the district court. For that reason alone, I think that's improper here. But even so, of course, speculating why Ms. McElmurry was upset is just that. It's speculation. Ms. Metcalf cannot avoid summary judgment by speculating about why Ms. McElmurry was acting the way she was, particularly here, when Ms. McElmurry explained why she was acting the way she was. It's in the timeline, and it's in Ms. McElmurry's deposition testimony. She's saying, look, was I direct with Ms. Metcalf? Yeah, I was, because I was frustrated. She wasn't getting it. She wasn't understanding the severity of this issue. She was putting patient care behind her mandatory meetings. I was upset about that. She's a management level employee. We expect more of her. So yes, I was direct. Assuming that that's retaliatory is just speculating about her state of mind. And we can't speculate to avoid summary judgment.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you very much, Ms. Chambers. Mr. Redden, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will first address Ms. Chambers' most recent argument, which is that we cannot argue on appeal that Ms. McElmurry's conduct during the October 4 and September 27 interactions is evidence of retaliation. That's incorrect. In fact, at the district court level, we argued that her conduct on September 27 and October 4 actually rose to the level of prohibited retaliation under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. We are not arguing that on appeal. However, that is the way that it was argued to the district court. So it's very clear that we're drawing a connection between Ms. McElmurry's conduct during those two interactions and her retaliatory intent. So Ms. Chambers' argument is just doesn't reflect the facts as they were presented to the court, the district court. The other thing, I think I'd like to address here is Ms. Chambers' assertion that we're arguing that it didn't matter if the four decision makers had knowledge and that they, you know, that it works one way or the other. Now, we actually think that it is true that it doesn't matter, okay, because we think that there's sufficient evidence to show that from which a jury could conclude that the timeline itself is retaliatory together with Ms. Montgomery's conduct during the two prior interactions. However, I would point out that, you know, there's clear evidence when the facts are viewed in the light most favorable to Ms. Metcalf, that two of the decision makers had knowledge. It was both Ms. Iverson, and then Ms. Iverson says that she went to the president of Regina, Mr. Thompson, and told him about what Ms. Metcalf had reported to her. And that his response—
Mr. Redden, when is that, where is that in the record? I looked at her trial test or her deposition testimony, and I see her telling Ms. Metcalf that she was going to report it to Thompson, but I didn't see where she had.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Your Honor. That's in Ms. Metcalf's deposition, actually.
Okay, so that's hearsay is what that is. Is hearsay evidence competent evidence to oppose summary judgment?
Well, it's not hearsay evidence because Ms. Iverson is able to respond to it. She was deposed and she said, no, that didn't happen. She's part of Alina. She's an employee. She was an employee at the time. And so it's our view that that is not hearsay, but it is reflected on page 238 of Ms. Metcalf's deposition transcript. And Mr. Thompson's, according to Ms. Iverson, when she was speaking to Ms. Metcalf, she said she told Mr. Thompson that his response was, it's not surprising that Ms. Metcalf would put patient safety first and that he would speak to Ms. Montgomery about it. And so obviously the patient safety piece was, according to Iverson in this conversation, communicated to Mr. Thompson, as well as Ms. Metcalf, its relation to Ms. Metcalf's complaint regarding Ms. Montgomery. And so despite that knowledge—
Let me stop you there. Is there any evidence that Iverson conveyed your client's October 5th complaint, which she said, I'm making a complaint against Montgomery for putting patients at risk? What's the record evidence that Montgomery was aware of that when she created the timeline or at the time of the October 15th meeting?
Well, in Ms. Montgomery's deposition on page 142 and 143, she talks about a conversation with Mr. Thompson where he went to tell her, hey, I've got these concerns that have been raised by Ms. Metcalf. What say you? And she proceeded to falsely tell him that Ms. Metcalf was more fixated about meetings and the concerns raised about Mr. Messer. She falsely claimed that she had tried to problem solve during this meeting, September 27th conversation with Ms. Metcalf, but that Ms. Metcalf wasn't receptive. That's not true. So she took the opportunity when Mr. Thompson went to her and said, hey, Ms. Metcalf has expressed these concerns, she took that opportunity to go on attack mode right there. And so despite that knowledge that Ms. Metcalf had these concerns to the extent that she wanted to make a report about the director of HR, these two decision makers claim to have just run with it and accepted the results of Ms. Montgomery's investigation without bringing in somebody who's clearly unbiased to do the investigation. And I would also point out that Ms. Montgomery was in the room when the four decision makers were discussing what it was that they were going to do about it. And so there were five people there. Ms. Montgomery was one of them. I just wanted to point those things out to the court in light of Ms. Chambers' argument today.
Thank you, Mr. Redden. Any questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you both, counsel. This matter was very well briefed and very well argued. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory timeframe.